Hello, and welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. Today is the 30th of June, 2000. I think it's the 30th. It's got to be. Yes, that's right, Tuesday. It's the evening. It's coming up to 6 o'clock, I think. Am I right about that either? I beg your pardon. It's coming up to 7 o'clock. I think it's quarter to seven. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. And I am sitting in my front room. It's a beautiful day outside. It's been very lovely. Have been sort of, what have I been doing? I've been doing a bit of writing, actually. A bit of sending out of books. Been answering a lot of emails today. A bit of reading as well. It's been a sort of a bit of a day off from everything. Although catch up as well. So it's a funny old day. I suspect we should be off to the land tomorrow to go and water everything. We've got stuff coming and we've got stuff to pick up in the coming days. So it's going to be a bit of travelling here, there and everywhere. But anyway, that's what it is. That's our life at the moment. And of course, there are a few events that I shall be appearing at. There's the Weekend Truth Festival. There is one in Derby. Forget what it's called. It was on the video this morning. And somebody's asked me to go down, I think, in Dorset to give another talk and the opportunity to sell more of my books, which has been lovely. And talking of books, I happened to pick up yesterday, I've got a number of books, as you know, I've got loads of books, but I picked up one that I hadn't read, and I thought it was on my shelf to read, and I thought Julia and I would enjoy reading this. Let me just turn the light on for a second. This is Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Of course, it's Thomas Hardy, and it's a classic set in Hardy's Wessex, of course. Tess of the D'Urbervilles is a moving novel of hypocrisy and double standards, it says on the back. Its challenging subtitle, A Pure Woman, infuriated critics when the book was first published in 1891, and it was condemned as immoral and pessimistic. It tells of Tess D'Urberfield, the daughter of a poor and dissipated villager, who learns that she may have descended from the ancient family of D'Urberville. In her search for respectability, her fortunes fluctuate wildly, and the story assumes the proportions of a Greek tragedy. It explores Tess's relationship with two very different men, her struggle against the social mores of the rural Victorian world, which she inhabits, and the hypocrisy of the age. So that sounds fascinating, doesn't it? Complete and unabridged. It's Mayor of Casterbridge I read. This was, as it says, first published in, whenever it was, 1891. This edition that I have here, I think is 2000. Yeah, something like that, with additional introductions and bits and bobs, which don't really overly interest me. I often wonder whether that's for, for you university people, the academics. I mean, I just want to read the story. But then there is the author's explanatory note to the first edition. And he says the main portion of the following story appeared with slight modifications in the Graphic newspaper. Other chapters, more especially addressed to adult readers, in the Fortnightly Review and the National Observer, as episodic sketches. And my thanks are tendered to the editors and proprietors of those periodicals for enabling me now to piece the trunk and limbs of the novel together and print it complete as originally written 2 years ago. Which is interesting that he had to split it up. I will just add that the story is sent out in all sincerity for the purpose as an attempt to give artistic form to a true sequence of things. And in respect to the book's opinions and sentiments, I would ask any too gentle reader who cannot endure to have said what everybody nowadays thinks and feels to remember a well-worn sentiment of St. Jerome's. If an offence comes out of the truth, better is it that the offence cometh, than the truth be concealed. So that's very interesting. Let's just have a quick look. The first phase, the first phase, the second. I like that phase. The first chapter, chapter one, the maiden. I'll just read a tiny bit from it, just to get us in the whet our appetite for a moment. Although I will be, Julia and I will be enjoying this. We've got a number of books. Our book reading now is quite impressive, and we just love reading. It's mostly me that does the reading, but Julia's very good at it as well. I'm still lumbering through stuff. On an evening in the latter part of May, a middle-aged man was walking homeward from Shaston to the village of Marlott in the adjoining vale of Blackmore, or Blackmore, spelt M-O-R-E or M-O-O-R. The pair of legs that carried him were rickety, and there was a bias in his gait which inclined him somewhat to the left of a straight line. He occasionally gave a smart nod, as if in confirmation of some opinion, though he was not thinking of anything in particular. An empty egg basket was slung upon his arm, and the nap of his hat was ruffled, a patch being quite worn away at its brim, where his thumb came in taking it off. Presently he was met by an elderly parson astride on a grey mare, who, as he rode, hummed a wandering tune. "Good nighty," said the man with the basket. "Good night, Sir John," said the parson. The pedestrian, after another pace or two, halted and turned round. "Now, sir, begging your pardon, we met last on market day on this road about this time, and I said good night, and you made good night, Sir John, as now."
"That's right, I did."
"And once before that, a month ago."
"I may have."
"Then what might you be meaning in calling me Sir John these different times, when I be plain Jack Durbeyfield, the haggler?" The parson rode a step or two nearer. "It was only my whim," he said, and after a moment's hesitation, "it was on account of a discovery I made some little time ago whilst I was hunting up pedigrees for the new country history. I'm Parson Tringham, the antiquity of Stagford Lane. Don't you really know, Durbeyfield, that you are the lineal representative of the ancient and knightly family of the D'Urbervilles, who derive their descent from Sir Pagan Durbeyfield, that renowned knight who came from Normandy with William the Conqueror, as appears by Battle Abbey Roll?"
I've never heard of it before, sir."
"Well, it's true. Throw up your chin a moment, so that I may catch the profile of your face better. Yes, that's the Durbeyfield nose and chin, a little debased. Your ancestor was one of the 12 knights who assisted the Lord of Estemavilla in Normandy in his conquest of Glamorganshire. Branches of your family held manors all over the parts of England. Their names appears in pipe rolls in the time of King Stephen. In the reign of King John, one of them was rich enough to give a manor to the Knights Hospitallers. And in Edward II's time, your forefather, Brian, was summoned to Westminster to attend the great council there. You declined a little in Oliver Cromwell's time, but no serious extent. And in Charles II's reign, you were made Knights of the Royal Oak for your loyalty. Aye, there have been generations of Sir Johns among you, and if knighthood were hereditary, like a baronetcy, as particularly it was in old times, when men were knighted from father to son, you would be Saint Sir John now."
"You don't say so."
"In short," concluded the parson, decisively snacking his leg with his switch, "there is hardly such another family in England."
"Dazed my eyes, and isn't there?" said Durbeyfield.
"And here, and here I've been knocking about year after year from pillar to post as if I was no more than the commonest fella in the parish. And how long has this news about me been known, Parson Tringham?" The clergyman explained that as far as you're aware, it had quite died out of knowledge and could hardly said to be known at all. His own investigations had begun on a day in the preceding spring when, having engaged in tracing the vicissitudes of the Durbeyfield family, he had observed Durbeyfield's name on his wagon and had thereupon been led to make inquiries about his father and grandfather till he had no doubt on the subject. Isn't that lovely? That's just the beginning of the story, of course. And I haven't read that before. So there we go. That is Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Now, of course, I'm sure most of you listeners to this would be very familiar with Hardy's work. And, of course, down in Dorset, it's a very lovely county. I have been reading some J.B. Priestley. Julia and I are currently reading Bright Day by J.B. Priestley. And I'm privately reading, because I love reading, so when Julia's not here or she's busy or whatever, I would take myself off for half an hour. I'm reading It's an Old Country by J.B. Priestley. This is published, I don't know whether it's a relatively early one of his. I think it is. It says on here 1967, so I don't really know. But it is written, I'm just trying to think of the right way of expressing it. Excuse me, Yuri. Sort of quite scantly. The story gets involved. I won't go into the story or anything, but he's writing sparingly at some points. And there's bits that I think, oh, I'd love to know that, that he skips over and you don't get some descriptions and things, perhaps, or some feelings of the character. And then other things seem to go very rapidly. Conversation goes from naught to 100, as it were, in when he meets new people and he wants to get to the point. It kind of gets to the point too rapidly for my liking, which is a bit disappointing. So there's that. I have, and I think we looked at this, I can't remember. This is an R.F. Delderfield. I have to say, R.F. Delderfield, I've been spoilt by R.F. Delderfield. I just find him an exquisite writer. He has a habit of killing off in his sagas, favourite characters of mine, but there we are. The Serve Them All His Day, so it's To Serve Them All My Days, was one of his famous ones, was turned into a TV series. That one went on and on, but it was the first of his that I read, and I wasn't quite ready for him. But this one is somewhat different. The God is an Englishman. I've read the first one, which was quite a tome, and I have the two subsequent books, which are Renaissance, Give Us This Day by R.F. Delderfield, the second book that makes up the enthralling third. Wait a minute. The second of two books that make up the enthralling third part of the... Well, how do you... What? I don't understand. There's three books. It says the second of two books which make up the enthralling third part of the famous... Well, can somebody explain that to me? How can it be... The second of, surely that should be the second of three books that make up the enthralling third part of the world famous Swan Saga. What am I missing there? There's three books. The first one is God is an Englishman. And then there are two others, which is the other one is Theirs Was Their Kingdom. Does this give me an indication? I've got to work this out now. I'm looking inside. So the Swan Saga, book one, God is an Englishman. Book three, Give Us This Day. So this slimmer version is the third book, although it says book two. Oh, I see. Wait a minute. So how bizarre is that? I think I've understood. So book two... Sorry. I know this sounds completely nonsense. Right. The Swan Saga. God is an Englishman is book one. It seems I have here book two, which is Theirs Was the Kingdom, which is almost 1,000 pages. I think it's 900 and something. 896. Right. And then the third book has been split into two. And I've got the second of that. So I understand it now that I've got the second book of the third part. Give us this day, book two, reconnaissance. So I've got to now buy. Why would you split that up? So, but anyway, it'll take me weeks to get through the second part of this. I'm just going to have a look. View of the River, December 1878. Toward noon, when Swan's carters, stablemen, and van boys gathered in the yard and about the sprawl of the sheds and warehouses, munching their bread and cheese and spilling shards of pastry from penny pies bought at the stand lower down Tooley Street, cohorts of London sparrows attended them. When dusk fell, when the gates were locked after the last homing wagon and the only men inside the enclosure were watchmen, the sparrows, most knowing of London's cadgers, flew west to scavenge Covent Garden, abandoning Swan's Bermondsey headquarters to a pair of robins. The robins then assumed private ownership of the rectangle and were always in hopes that the tall, broad-shouldered man with the friendly eyes and the curious rolling gait would stay overnight and would be on hand to provide breakfast at first light, pushing wide the tower casement and calling them to perch on the sill of the old belfry. Often enough he appeared, having slept on the camp bed. Often he appeared, having slept on the camp bed he had there, and they heard his cheerful shout in the morning as the grey light probed the swirling river mists, so that they took off from the warehouse gutter, dropping down within pecking reach of his large, horny hand. He called, as always, "Hello, you two! Help yourselves! Take the chill off the morning!" and grinned as they advanced warily to feed from his hand, paying no heed when he cleared his throat, threw up his head and sniffed the damp air, accepting him as one of their regular early risers thereabouts, with time as well as pasty crumbs on his hands, and a geniality that he would shed once the working day had begun. And he had opened his newspaper and settled to his desk. His presence there at this hour was irregular. In spring and summer he might watch the dawn from the tower casement no more than once a fortnight, but at this season of the year, coming up to Christmas, he was sometimes there for days at a stretch, a strongly made, shambling man who seemed to enjoy his isolation high above the wilderness of slate and tile, a man who had a word for them even when the great desk of his was spread with papers and he seemed absorbed in never-ending tasks. Beautifully written, beautifully crafted. I'm spoilt with that. So, yes, I've got that. And so we're in Priestley at the moment, but then I've got this other Delderfield. How are we doing with time? I don't want to bore you too much. Charlie, Come Home. Sorry, Come Home, Charlie, and Face Them. Curious title, that is. And I think I read a bit of that. This one starts very intriguingly. This is a short, just one-off novel. So you've got to be prepared for the sagas to sort of get involved, and they're terrific, though. This one starts as thus. They didn't hang people anymore. That was my first thought when I saw them digging. And after that, another thought. They would scarcely have time to run down the truth of it if, as I thought unlikely, the trail went circle once again and came back to Charlie. They hadn't been able to make a breakthrough when the trail was fresh, so why should they achieve one now, after nearly 40 years? It was this feeling of security, of course, that enabled me to toddle up there, day after day, and watch the earth-moving machines at work. I could look on with indifference, wearing that slightly superior expression people with nothing to do wear whenever they watch others at work. A stooping, greying, used-up man taking his morning constitutional. Without a wisp of guilt or a tremor of fear, I had survived after all. I didn't have long to enjoy the victory, but at least I had lived to see it through to the finish, and that was something that I had never expected. So, so there we are. I think this is obviously from the guy who did whatever he did, and whether he gets caught in the end, we don't know. So, yes, so that's again, very slightly differently. But I like that. I do like the descriptive stuff. It helps me. I mean, I love reading lots of different authors in different positions because it... I think I mentioned in A Naked Englishman some time ago that I was... When I started writing, I was reading something about writing because I felt I needed guidance, you know, and I went online and I read some stuff about creative writing and all of this from gurus, you know, so-called gurus. And they said you should never use the word was. It was raining. And in my book that I started with, Splidge the Cragflinger, which was a children's book, originally what the draft that I had, it was raining in the land of Gud. It never stopped. It must have done occasionally, otherwise the city would have been washed away by floods long ago. One day, King Gudamak was peering out the oblong-shaped window in the palace. And I'd use was. So then I thought, well, God, you know, they would say that was lazy, lazy writing, not poetic, not worthy, you know. And I thought, oh, crikey, I'd better learn how to do it, you know. So then you go, rain was pouring down in torrents into the... No, not rain was pouring down into... Because rain was, that'd be the second word, it was raining. But you had to find different ways of saying that it was raining. As water pelted down through the gutters and gushed out of the downpipes into the street, the man huddled under a umbrella, you might say. But sometimes all you just want to just, you know, you don't want to have a descriptive bit and sort of try and churn away from it. You just want to say it was raining. It's as basic as that and move on. And I noticed in some modern writers, they've obviously taken heed of this, and they sort of become desperately trying to write in a poetic fashion, which becomes annoying because you just want to move on, not necessarily with the plot, but with what it's trying to say. And then I read things like J.P. Priestley and other famous writers, R.F. Delafield and so on, and... Sure, and of course, you know, Thomas Hardy and people like that. And they're using was all the time, you know, the verb to be, it was, it will be, and all of this as part of their normal language. And I thought to myself, I wish that I'd never read that post because it's like they teach you something and you go, oh, right, I mustn't use it. And then I became frightened of using that it was whatever it was. Now, of course, I don't, you know, it's taken me a while to get rid of that useless piece of creative writing stuff. That's not to say you want to do it all the time and just say the man was tall, he was wearing a raincoat, he was wearing brown shoes. But you could do that if that was the deliberate type of thing you wanted to get over. That, you know, it was raining. It was because of the cold. It was because of this, that and the other. It was, and you repeat a phrase deliberately. That's a different sort of technique for a certain part, but you wouldn't want to do it all the time. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention it. So there we go. I don't think I need to bore you too much more, do I? You've probably got lives to live and things to do. So I've had my dinner and I'm just probably going to have a pipe and a nice cup of something warm. I think maybe a cup of coffee or something would be quite nice at this time. And I may have a snooze. Probably, actually, I want to try and finish this J.B. Priestley book. And while I've got some hours to myself, Julia's popped out, so I've got a bit of time to myself. So I thought I'd record this and have a little read with over a cup of coffee. So there we go. That's it. Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you. Till next time. Toodle pip.